Gus Kitson. This recording is part of the oral history project carried out by the Suffolk Horse Society in 2013 with advice from Cambridge Community Heritage and a generous grant from the Heritage Lotteries Fund. In the recording you will hear the voice of Gus Kitson describing his memories of the Suffolk Punch Heavy Horse. Gus is a retired wheelwright and is also a Suffolk Punch owner. The recording was made by Hilary Cadman, who was a member of the Suffolk Horse Society. The date of the recording was the 16th of May 2013, and it was carried out at his home at Sibton, Suffolk. The duration of the recording is about 31 minutes.
This is Hilary Cadman here with Gus Kitson, retired wheelwright, who lives in Sibton, Suffolk. Good morning, Gus.
Good morning, Hilary.
And where were you born and where did you live?
I was born in Saxmundham and I'm the last of 12. I had six sisters and five brothers. Yeah, get it right. There was six of each. And father never earned £20 a week in his life.
Really?
But we never went without food on the table, that was the main thing. We wore hand-me-downs, but that didn't matter. We were a happy family. Father and mother, they lived for their family, and we had a wonderful childhood. And father used to take us for long walks on Sundays, and because he worked with wood, he always explained all the different trees to us and anything to do with the countryside. So we grew up with the knowledge of what was around us, and to this day that is what I survive on, as everything on this earth was sent here and it's all free if you take the time and trouble to notice that the best things in life are free.
And what did your father do?
My father worked at Leyston Works. He had two jobs in his life. One was he worked on Leyston Works and he built thrashing machines on Leyston Works. He obviously served his apprenticeship there. And then just before the war, the Second World War, he moved to Saxmundham and he was worked at Saxmundham Sawmills as the saw doctor. And he sharpened all the saws that ran the mill at Saxmundham until he retired. And then he went back until he was 70, and then he went a few days when they got in a muddle with they hadn't got any saws to use, and then he did finally pack up because he weren't very well with his heart, and then after that the sawmills closed and that was the end of that, I'm afraid.
And what about you? What year did you leave school and what did you do?
I left school in 1957. I was not an academic. I hated every day I was at school. I ran out of the pavement, out of the playground and clapped my heels together, jumped up in the air, and I was so pleased to leave. And I started on a farm at Swefflin, at George Holden's. And fortunately, he still had two Suffolk horses. But as long as I can ever remember, I've always had an interest in horses. And if I could go to any farm around Saxmundham where there was horses, I would. And just to be standing in a stable was enough when I was a young lad. And I did actually work for a farmer called Jock Nichols at Saxmundham, and he borrowed a big Persian mare from the farmer next door, Mr. Reed. And we went scoop and beat with that, and because I weren't very big in those days, and this great big man, I was worried about her walking on my feet, so I pulled her over to one side a bit, and Jock hoed about 10 yards of beat out, and duly swore at me, so after that he put me up on her back, and I used to ride her all day, scoop and beat. And I was thrilled to bits just to be with the horses. And then, like I say, as I left school, George had two Suffolks left, and the old mare, the favourite old mare he wouldn't part with, and I used her just about every day for the first year of my working life. And and the young one they had, we used him just when we were carting sugar beet off Dandy. He was deemed the young horse. He was 10 years old when I went, but we have got a picture of him somewhere with George, but he was a bit flighty when you wouldn't do to top a beat and throw it on his back, he'd be gone. But and then when I led him off the field, he was a bit hasty, you know, but he was all right. He done the job, that was the main thing. But that was how I really got sort of in, you know, the love of horses. Never ever dreamed that I would own one, but you never know where life is going to lead you to, that's the thing. And having worked on the farm for a year with George while his son had his appendix out, I think it was, that was the reason I went there. Well, after a year, I fancied working with cattle, and I got a job at Saxham Undermutt Street Farm as under cowman, and we had 40 Frisian cows there we used to milk. And the cowman was a chap called Richard Spatcher, who I'm still friendly with Richard. We remain friends all our life, really. And I just loved it, really. I never complained about getting up at starting work at 5:45. That was no problem to me, because prior to that, I'd worked on the bookstall at Saxmanham Railway Station from the age of 13, and used to get the newspapers off the train at 5:45 every morning anyhow to take to the bookstall. So early mornings has always been part of my life.
So what led to you becoming a wheelwright?
Well, eventually, having married my wife, we moved into Whitehouse Farm, Sipton, and had this love of horses. We started with we had some ponies after we'd been married about 3 years. We bought some ponies and got them broke in, and we started driving. And then I bought a little trap that needed repairing, and I rebuilt the whole thing, because that was when I started looking at it, that was quite rotten. So I rebuilt it, and I've still got it to this day. That was 1973 or 4, I think I rebuilt that. And then I done another pony trap up, and I built one or two odd ones.
How did you have the skills to do that?
Well, not being an educated person, I was born to work with my hands, so I just adapt myself to whatever task lies in front of me, be it metal or wood. I laugh to people and say, every time I change my trade, I just change my apron. It's as simple as that, really. I was a full-time plasterer, because after I left the cattle, I went into building trade, and I became a full-time plasterer because I was too late to have an apprenticeship as a carpenter or a bricklayer. But plasterers were thin on the ground, and so I was able to grasp that and became a plasterer for quite a lot of years. But then, let's say, doing the pony carts up, I eventually led me to one day hoping I'd buy a Suffolk Punch, which I did, and he's now 24. Well, I had one prior to that, which I lost when he was 3 years old, but Phil Morley. And then once I got Adam, this one I got now, I needed, I'd got an old tumble which I'd bought 20 years previous at a farm that sold out round the corner here, and that had been sitting in the barn for years and years, and I thought I must get that repaired one day, and the wheels wanted doing. And I was sort of friendly with a chap, and he'd done a gypsy caravan wheel, so he had a rough idea, and we got together, and anyhow we done these wheels, and they're still going today, they're no problem. But and then I had an old wheelwright in the village called Hubert Aldrin, and he was quite fascinated the fact that I was having a go. And I went and saw Hubert one day and to ask him several questions, and Hubert said he shoe me a wheelbarrow wheel, and he said, you ought to go home and make one of them. He said, if you can make one of them, you can make anything. So 3 evenings Well, on the third evening, that nearly became firewood because I was so frustrated trying to put this thing together. Anyhow, I left it and went back to it the fourth night and completed it, heated the tyre up and put that on, cleaned it up, took it back to Hubert, and I said, "Is that all right, Hubert?" I said, "What are you going to give me for that?" He said, 11 out of 10. So I was quite pleased with that. And that really started it off, and I kept doing different wagons. Kept buying wagons and things and doing, and made sure that every time I went to the show with my horse, I took a different wagon. And I think this opened up my shop window eventually, because people noticed that I'd always got something different and asked me where I'd got it and what, you know, how I'd, who'd done it up, and I used to say I'd done it myself. And slowly the work came in, and the business slowly took off. It was a bit hit and miss at first. I just concentrated mainly on heavy horse wheels, you know, wagons and things, until I got started, and slowly as I built my workshop up, I was then able to start rebuilding wagons and tumbles and all sorts of things, you know. But that took a while because I hadn't got the machinery to help me with a lot of it. But eventually, when I could afford to buy another machine somewhere, an old one as a rule, I'd hunt one out somewhere. And then that got me going, you know, the business took off, and I've made quite a name for myself, really, which I've been quite proud of, really. And also, I've been amazed the places that has taken me, and I've given odd talks and things to different people, and I think I had about 20 years I had at it, and I never regretted a day of it. Absolutely loved it.
Kew Gardens once.
I did, yes. Yeah, I was. That was quite strange, really, because Mary came up the yard one morning and she said, "I got somebody on the phone from Kew Gardens," and I just thought it was a joke, you know, anyhow. And I got talking to this chap who happened to be Tony Kirkham, who was head of all the trees at Kew Garden. And I was standing in my yard, and my yard is absolutely full of turkeys, geese and chickens, because I like things old-fashioned. And he said, "That sounds like you're standing in an interesting place." I said, yeah. Anyhow, he'd got this great big tree transplanting machine in Kew, which I'd never seen one. So he said, "The best thing you can do is get on a train and come up to Kew, and they'd pay the expenses." And so Mary and I hopped on a train the following week and went up to Kew. And I took a little photograph album with me, and the first picture was where I'd stood in the yard with all the ducks and geese and various wagons I'd repaired and wheels and things like that. And we went and looked at this machine, and that was a huge thing, and I just walked around and kicked the wheels, and I said, "Yeah, that'll be all right." And he couldn't believe it. He said, "Is it serious?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "Why is that?" He said, well, "You'd never believe how hard I've been trying to find somebody to do this job." I said, "Yeah, that's a little bigger than normal, but that won't matter." Anyhow, they agreed to supply all the wood and everything. And I said, "Before we start," I said, "I haven't got any pieces of paper to say I can do anything." I said, "I usually just change aprons and that's it." And I show him my book with the photographs in, and he was well pleased. Anyhow, we got a nice relationship going with Kew Gardens, and we done the machine. They sent all the wood down to repair it with and everything, and they came down and had several visits here, and any excuse to get down here, really. I enjoyed it, and they especially liked our ham from the butchers, our Suffolk ham, and Mary's pickled beetroot and things like that used to go in with jars and things. And eventually I contacted Nigel when the thing was finished, because they wanted to plant these trees in Kew, and Nigel agreed to take a pair of Suffolks up, and we all dressed up in period costume and ended up planting seven trees on the Broadwalk in Kew Gardens. And on the 10th anniversary, Nigel, Christine and myself and Mary went back and had a diet queue and couldn't believe how large the trees had grown in that time.
What sort of size was this tree planter?
Well, I could just not quite walk under it. I had to duck just a little bit, but it was quite a tall thing. And because they used to dig great big trees out up to weighing up to 5 tons and hang the great big root ball underneath. So it had to be quite tall to enable them to do that. And that was called the devil, this machine, because there would be about 40 men working with this thing, digging these trees out. And then they would dig a ramp down and in this great big hole, and then a ramp up the other side to get the horses out. The horse would pull it down to the bottom. Then they would lower the tree into the where that was going to be. And then the machine came apart, and then they would drag each piece out with the horses and then assemble it again once they'd got it out. And then they'd have to infill everything, you know. That was quite a task. And quite often, why they called it the devil was apparently quite often somebody would break a leg or an arm in the process of planting a large tree. But that was... and after there'd been an article in the Heavy Horse World, a chap from Derby, Nottinghamshire, contacted me, who had actually worked for Barron's, who built the machine. He'd been an apprentice there, and he rung me up, and I actually called up and saw him. I was up that part of the world, and I went and hunted him out. A very interesting old lad he was. And as soon as we went in, he said to Mary, "Put the kettle on the hot plate, and so we can have a cup of tea." So she was in charge of making the tea straight away. And he was the one who told me how they built the ramps down, you know, to plant the trees and that. He'd actually worked with them. So that was quite interesting.
You mentioned at the beginning that you started off making wagon wheels.
Yeah.
How did that then turn into doing bigger jobs and more different types of wheels?
I think once I'd done several wagon wheels, and then... I didn't advertise. The only advertisement I ever put in was in the Heavy Horse World in the Wheelwrights Directory. I just put my name and address in there. And then the Worshipful Company of Wheelwrights contacted me because they'd seen my name in there. And they actually wanted me to become a yeoman of the guild, but I declined the offer because that was going to cost me money and I weren't that rich at the time. But the thing is, I did go up to their dinner once in London, and there was 14 wheelwrights, and out of the 14, I seemed to be the only one who was really busy. A lot of them were sort of part-time people, but I was sort of, you know, I just became busier and busier. I think I just, at the time I started, I think there were so many people wanted... old wagons restored for showing, and I just happened to hit the right spot at the right time. I think that was what it was. And then once you're done that and they talk to other people, and then you end up with pony trap wheels, gypsy caravan wheels, and all sorts of people turn up, and so you have to you just don't know what's ever coming around the corner. That's the thing, and that was the nice part about it. I would have anything up to 14 wheels waiting to be done at sometimes, you know, ranging from 2 foot to 5 foot 5, you know, big wagon wheels and things like that. And so, and then I had this old boy John who came over to paint a tumble for me once, because I weren't into the painting, well, especially lining up, and old John came to help me, and he painted this tumble up, which was a Fenland one, which had quite a lot of fancy lines on. And he helped me finish building the paint shop. And 12 years later, when I retired, John left me. And we had 12, and he was so clever as well. I learned a lot of John. And we built all sorts of things in them 12 years and never had a dull moment, really, you know. Wonderful.
Where did you source your wood from?
I used to go to a woodyard in at Sudburn on the way to Orford. I found a chap there with a sawmill, a very old-fashioned sawmill, and he used to find me quite a bit of ash. And then I found another chap from Nayland, I don't think his name now, Bug, yeah. Anyhow, he rung me up and said he'd got some trees, and no, Roger Clark rung me, that's right, and told me that he'd got these trees, would I be interested? So I rung him, and he asked me how I wanted them cut up, and he delivered them, and he was a bit cheaper than the other chap, so I ended up getting quite a lot of him, you know, wherever I could get them, really. And then people knew you wanted them, so people would offer you trees occasionally, and I'd get them cut up, you know. And I used to keep I built a big wood shed, a drying shed, and I would keep a stock. I'd buy stock every year to keep it going, you know, to get it seasoned and that. Sometimes demand outstripped the seasoning, I'm afraid. That was a bit like that at the time. That was, you know, I remember one night I had a load of trees in, and my boy came out after tea with me, and we cut out about 8 sets of shafts one evening out of the, and that, you know, that just eat trees, cutting shafts out, really, you know. And but that was, like I say, most enjoyable time of my life, really. I never been bored with it. Loved it, every minute of it. But I decided to retire at 65 because I used to go to a little show at Swefflin, in which I've just recently been, and the chap there had stayed on to build a barn for some people till he was 70, and I went round one day and he was making a trolley for his stationary engine, and I said, "You're enjoying your retirement then, Ronnie?" He said, "Yeah," he said, "but I wish I had the other 5 years," he said, "when I should have retired." And I thought, there's a lesson there. So that was a lesson I learnt right away, and so I always said I would pack up at 65, and since then I have built myself 3 shepherd's huts, a gypsy caravan, and done lots of little odd jobs for people, but there's no money involved now. We just help people out with various little jobs, and I've got 2 or 3 old boys who come over. We call ourselves the geriatric creche now, and we restored the lych gate for Sipton Church. We repaired all that, and we've done various little jobs for different people. We don't want money, we just enjoy ourselves, and I've got the workshop, so we use it. That's as simple as that, really.
There was one last question I particularly wanted to ask you, and that was about the tools. I read somewhere that the tools for wheel writing haven't really changed since the Iron Age.
Well, no. You can, like I say, you can use modern machines, which helps you a lot, you know, a lot. But I got into a way of making spokes. I mean, some people have spoke-making machines, but I just got into a way. I used father's, his old tools, really, because they were wooden, boxwood, and I found they were the nicest. I got on better with them, and I did a modern metal version of them, spoke shaves. I always used father's old ones, and I got into a way of cutting them basically out on an old bandsaw, and then a few shaves with his spoke shave and a bit of sand, and they seem to come together quite quickly, you know. And you just get into a rhythm of doing these things. And if I was on my own in the workshop doing wheels, John would be over painting the wagon, and he would come in, he'd be astounded how quick I'd put all these wheels together, you know. But you get, if you're just on your own and concentrating, you just get in a way of doing it. And I, like I said, I'd have 14 waiting to be done, so you'd get a rhythm going, and didn't matter what size they were, that they're all the same, you know. And the easiest way to really get going is to pull one to bits and see how it's made. But you do get the odd one that's quite complicated sometimes. I had one, and when we put it on an axle and spun it with a marker, that was actually 7¾ inches out of true. And I scratched my head with it a bit, and I took the tire off and loosened it all up and put the tire back on, screwed it down to my tire and plate to level it all up. But they were still out, so I took the whole wheel to bits and discovered that whoever had repaired it had put that had 14 spokes, and 7 of them they'd put in the wrong way round, and that was what was causing the problem. So I had to alter all them and to true the wheel up. But yeah, you get odd things like that. And some I had which were done by another chap, I can't remember his name and I wouldn't mention his name, but they happened to be very dangerous the way he'd done them. And that was one thing I always made sure they were done correctly and safely, and I never had a wheel break down on me anywhere. So I'm quite proud of that fact. But this chap had done terrible things, and Nigel Oakley bought a wagon that had been done by him, and one of the hubs needed replacing. And while I took that hub apart, or took that wheel apart, I discovered what this chap had done. And I said to Nigel, because he had a farm park at the time, I said, I can't let you have this vehicle until I've had every wheel apart, because I said, you know, you're dealing with the public. And and Nigel agreed with him. He said, it's got to be safe. And so I had to take all the wheels apart, put them right, before the vehicle went to Nigel's.
Had he used the wrong wood? Because, I mean, I understand.
Yes, he'd not only used the wrong wood, he'd actually cut what we call the tangs off the spoke. The tang is the bit that goes into the felly, which is the outer rim of the wheel. And he'd cut them off. Rather than take the wheel apart, he'd cut them two off and just slipped a piece of wood in and then put a nail up through the spoke into it. And so that was totally unsafe. No way, you know, it was terrible. So, like I say, I wouldn't let the vehicle go out of the workshop until that was completely safe.
Can you just describe the three woods that are used in making the wheel?
The nave, or the hub, I tend to call it a hub, but a lot of people call it the nave, is made of elm. The reason they made it of elm was because that's one of the hardest woods to split. In fact, until Dutch elm came about, they never invented a log splitter. And then the spokes are made of oak, and in the early days they were made of riven oak, which was split, so that you had the maximum length of grain. And because at any one time with a wagon, you could have a big road wagon with 3 ton of corn on, and in theory the whole lot could be standing on 4 spokes. So that was the reason they had that. And ash was used for the fellies because it's got a little bit of spring in it, which took a bit of the shock out of it when roads were really rough, you know. So that was why they had that. And the dish on the wheel is designed because the roads used to be deep with ruts and the wagons sway from side to side. And if you didn't have that dish on, if the wheel weren't made like a dome, the hub would just be pushed straight out of the wheel. So, you know, that's where the dish was developed. And the older the wagon, the heavier the dish. As the roads improved and wagons and things became factory made, they decreased the dish in the wheels, you know, because that weren't required so much. But in the old 1800 wagons and that, they had a very heavy dish on them, you know, to compensate for the rock and the load, you know.
And then there's the final exciting bit of putting the metal rim on.
Yeah. That, you have a big metal tire and plate on the ground, and you screw your wheel down to that, and heat your tyre up, and the object of the exercise is to get the where you have to measure your rim of your wheel and then measure your tyre and leave an appropriate gap for that to shrink on and pull everything together. And the object is to get that tyre on and get it doused all within about a minute so that you don't actually burn the wood too much, you know. And that's a lovely sound when everything creak and groan and go together. That's quite a satisfying. And when they're finished, you used to sort of bounce them on the tyre and plate, and they would virtually bounce because they were really nice and tight. And then you know you've got a good wheel, you know. Yeah, I've had lots of fun doing that, and I had a Framlingham Historical Society came round one night, and I'd done two big tumble wheels for them, and they came out of the fire nice and red, and well, Tony Martin, he said we want plenty of steam and that, so they had a good night that night, and one of the ladies said, "That's the first time we had our speakers sweating," she said, which was rather nice. But anyway, they had a thoroughly enjoyable evening. We had one or two groups round when I was in business, you know, a wood turning group. We had the beef group from Saxmundham, and they all had a wonderful evening. You know, we'd put on a bit of a display for them, and they loved it.
Good. Well, that's most interesting.
Jolly good.
Anything else you want to add at all?
Can't think of anything offhand, really. That'll do for now.
Thank you.
Jolly good.